You're listening to It's More Complicated Than That, a podcast about world affairs produced by the students and faculty of the International Relations Program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York.
I'm Kevin Dunn, professor and chair of the International Relations Department at Hobart and William Smith Colleges.
And I'm Stacey Philbrick-Yadov, and I'm an associate professor in the International Relations Department as well.
Now, I was gone last semester leading a study abroad program to Galway, Ireland, so it's really nice to be back in the studio with you, Stacey, here doing this podcast. This episode, as always, we're joined by one of our international relations majors. This time it's Johanna Golden. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Johanna Golden. I'm a double major in international relations and French and Francophone studies with a minor in dance. And I was also abroad last semester in Tunisia, North Africa, and I'm super happy to be here with you too.
It's great to have you here, and we do love double majors at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, especially when one of them is an international relations major. It's really nice to have you here for this episode. And in this episode, we're discussing a brand new book entitled Yemen in the Shadow of Transition by our very own Stacey Philbrick-Yadov. Congratulations on having it published. It came out at the end of last year, right?
Yeah, thanks. It came out in October in Europe and in January in the U.S.
Nice, nice. Great, because it was published by Hearst and Oxford University Press. Is that correct?
Correct. So Hearst has a kind of small, pretty dedicated list of books on Yemen. And so they took the lead on marketing it in Europe, where the demand for books on Yemen is actually quite a bit more substantial than it is in the U.S., but Oxford is publishing it here.
That's great. Now, this is your second book. Your first book was published in 2013, and it was Islamist and the State, Legitimacy and Institutions in Yemen and Lebanon. And just to, I guess, mansplain a bit here, in that book, what you did was you examined what happens when Islamist political parties in the Middle East, but particularly your case studies of Yemen and Lebanon, choose to operate within the formal state structures and the degree to which their inclusion in those institutions generates a moderation of Islamist aims. Is that fair, real quick, 50-word summary?
You are one of three people who probably read it. So, that is reasonably accurate. But what happened in that book that was interesting to me is that as I was doing the fieldwork for that project, both of the parties I was studying entered cross-ideological alliances. And so I became really interested in alliance formation and the role of discourse in maintaining and shaping those alliances. And I kind of followed some of the same actors forward as I started this project.
But now, because the political landscape changed fairly dramatically in Yemen was it 2014 with the eruption of a violent civil war. I know explaining the civil war is very complicated given the multiple factors and actors involved, but can you briefly walk us through so that our listeners have an understanding of what's happened in the last, say, decade in Yemen?
Sure. And I'm glad you said decade, because I think one of the most fraught enterprises is trying to periodize the war or sort of designate its start point. And 2014 works in some ways, arguably 2015 in some other ways, and 2011 in even more ways. So, you know, I would personally think of the war as the consequence of a disintegrated and failed transitional project. And that transitional project, which is known as the Gulf Cooperation Council Initiative. It's kind of a mouthful, but it tells you who designed it, right? Yemen's Gulf neighbors, and they brought the UN on in support. It was really kind of a stabilization project more than a post-conflict transition project, and it was not well conceived or constructed, and it fell apart. Yemen was like many of its neighbors in having an uprising in 2011, and with a lot of different groups, some of them preformed members of like opposition parties, a lot of them much more independent and newly formed groups, making a broad range of claims and using a lot of different methods, both violent and nonviolent, in different parts of the country. And the transitional agreement gave kind of recognized power and voice to some of those actors, but not others. And it's not shocking that people who were left out, particularly the Houthis and the Southern movement, left out of transitional power sharing, became spoilers to that transition. That's a gross oversimplification. But in 2014, the Houthi movement really capitalized on discontent with the transitional process as a whole, marched into Sana'a, and essentially negotiated a new power-sharing agreement by force. By 2015, early 2015, that disintegrated entirely, and an international coalition launched the kind of internationalized phase of what might be considered a civil war.
And those the international actors, just to run through them, because it is quite a list of neighbors, but also global interests, right?
Absolutely. I think the most significant players would certainly be Saudi Arabia. It's often referred to as the Saudi-led coalition because Saudi Arabia is absolutely at its head. And it's important to recognize that that coalition using force, which also contains the United Arab Emirates as a prominent actor, is authorized by UN resolution, Security Council Resolution 2216. So it's sort of an authorized use of force in that sense. The United States provides considerable logistic support and military assistance, as do other European powers. So that's on the one side of the equation. Iran is actively involved in supporting the Houthi insurgency. Of course, one of the things that I think is under-remarked is that the coalition isn't unified and backs different actors on the ground. So the United Arab Emirates is really heavily involved in supporting southern secessionist interests, and the Saudis are more directly involved in backing some northern political figures.
Right. So, it's so complicated because, as you pointed out, you've got a very localized catalyst here for a kind of failed transition period outside of the conflict. And so you have these local, sometimes very local dynamics taking place. And you've got this regional kind of geopolitical strategizing between, say, Iran or Saudi Arabia mapped on top of this. So it's really, really complicated. So it's more complicated than we might immediately assume. Johanna, I know you had a couple of questions.
Yeah. So despite Yemen obviously being the home to the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world currently, is, I don't know if that's a fair way that
it's
you might
definitely
say it,
something that some organizations claim, but there's definitely some rhetorical arms racing over who gets to claim that. And I think the earthquakes last week in Turkey and Syria changed the landscape of that claim a little bit. But things are extraordinarily dire in Yemen, so let's go with that.
Right. So jumping off there, still most Americans cannot point to the country on a map. They do not know much about the country. I'm wondering how you, as an American, came to be interested in Yemen through your research.
That is a question I get asked a lot, and I have kind of three layers of that answer. So the really boring version is that I was in a PhD program in political science, and I needed a case selection that suited my research question, which was about Islamist political parties. So I needed to look in particular at countries where Islamist political parties were allowed to participate in political institutions freely and fairly. And Yemen was one of the best places to explore that. So there's a small literature on Islamist politics that does draw pretty heavily on Yemen because of its role in that way. But I have like a foodie answer. So people who know me well know that I really appreciate food. And when I was an undergraduate, I studied abroad in Israel, and I had a roommate who was Yemeni, or an Israeli of Yemeni extraction, and her mother used to make this like amazing bread called malawach that she would send the dough to our apartment, and we would eat it and enjoy it. And I wanted to go in search of that bread. And then I have, you know, another layer of the answer, which is like, why have I stayed sustained in my engagement with Yemen when I, for example, no longer work in Lebanon, right? That was a part of the first project, but Yemen has really endured in my professional and intellectual commitments and my personal commitments, and that's really because of a series of relationships with Yemenis that have been central and transformative on a lot of different levels for me.
Now, you've, in this work, you're shifted away from kind of examining political parties within institutional settings, looking at alliance formations, to asking some really pressing questions about post-conflict resolution and transitional justice. And you're examining the everyday work that Yemeni civil actors do, engaging in peace in these kind of highly fragmented spaces here. So this is actually a two-part question. One, you make a distinction about civil actors as being distinct from civilians, right? So one thing I want you to kind of talk me through here is how you kind of conceptualize what a civil actor is versus just a civilian. And then what would you say were the central kind of animating questions that you brought into this examination of these civil actors in the case of Yemen?
So thanks for that. I've been writing about civil actors for my whole career, but I didn't have that language until 2019 when I read something for the political violence class that I was teaching and realized that there was a way to think about what some civilians do to actually politically engage really intentionally in the context of conflict. So one of the things in Yemen is that, conflict actors and formal political parties have a designated seat at the negotiating table as a part of the international peace brokering process. But they also have somewhat, I would say, opportunistically captured that process. And there are a lot of other people who are actively trying to pursue political aims, pursue justice claims, as I focus on in the book, through a lot of different channels that are under-recognized. So the central kind of observation of the book, I guess, is that civilians, but here, and I'll talk what I mean, I'll explain what I mean by civil actors. Civil actors are doing so much more than surviving. It's tremendous that civilians survive conflict, and I'm not belittling that, but I am really interested in civilians who actively politically engage alongside the fighting, without fighting, right? There's also something else that I came on when I was teaching the political violence course was an essay by Erica Chenoweth and Adria Lawrence that talked about the need to hold violence and nonviolence in the same analytic field. And I don't think we do that very well. So this is an effort to do that. I want to think about, how should we conceptualize the projects of civilians, of civil actors, and the kinds of what kind of institutional responses do they need at different scales to really make their projects more visible and more tractable politically? So that's what I'm trying to do with the book. And I define civil actors coming out of this small literature as a form of contentious, nonviolent actors who may have very deeply held and very incommensurate political projects, but who recognize fundamentally, who are non-eliminationist in their relationship to their adversaries. So they recognize some basic right of their adversaries to continue to exist. And that seems to me to be pretty important in the context of civil war. And not all nonviolence is civil action. There are forms of nonviolence where people are talking about using nonviolent platforms to call for the elimination of a particular group. Like, that happens, and that's not civil action. So I'm talking about people who sit down in some way to work through and advance their political projects through disagreement, through deliberation, through bargaining, through everyday problem solving in some cases. And that's what the book is about.
Yeah, I know in the book you also use this concept of justice work, right? That you're focusing on justice work by local actors and then thinking about ways in which it can be scaled up to the national context. With that concept of justice work, what does that encapture, right? That seems to be a broad term.
It's super broad, okay. Right? So what I'm describing is the way that people diagnose problems in their communities and the things that they do to try to address them. And many people do describe that work in terms of justice explicitly. others less so, and particularly towards the end of the book when I talk about research and knowledge production as a form of justice work. That emerged sort of from my observations of what people were doing more than the self-conscious language that they were always using to describe that work. But then I ended up actually, you know, digging into it a little bit more and talking with some knowledge producers a little bit more about that work and seeing how they were conceptualizing both problem and problem solving.
Additionally, throughout the book, you utilize the capabilities approaches. We were wondering if you could walk us through what that theoretical approach is and why you found it so useful.
Well, I don't have to totally walk you through it because you took Intro to Comparative Politics
right.
with me, and I use the capabilities approach in my teaching. It's a body of normative work coming out of the field of development economics that asks what individuals can do and be and what is required to allow them to make meaningful choices. And that might not seem enormously relevant to peace building or civil war, but I actually found that there was the beginning of some discussion of the capabilities approach in the transitional or post-conflict justice literature that really emphasized the need to be pluralistic about the substance of choices and think about institutions that allow people to engage in transpositional scrutiny. And so let me come down from that. That's kind of like an abstract theoretical concept. But the capabilities approach, most people working in that tradition, particularly Amartya Sen, who's been really influential for me, don't hold that there's any transcendent justice out there to be achieved. But instead, that differently situated people can agree that something is unjust for different reasons, right? They don't even have to agree on why it's unjust. And then they can take action to eliminate that injustice. And that eliminating injustice or eliminating things we can agree are unjust is like the best that we can do, basically. And I find that pretty personally persuasive, right? But I also see it in the work that a lot of civil actors are engaged in, where they don't have to agree on why a certain bad situation is in fact a bad situation, but they can agree that they should be taking steps with each other to address it in some way. And I give some examples of this in the book. So thinking institutionally about what kind of settings enable that transpositional scrutiny. The question that got me going on the book, the puzzle of the book, really came when I was talking to people. I thought I understood really well that the transitional process had been deeply flawed and failed. And yet today, like, you know, in 2020, 2021, I was hearing from civil actors a lot of praise for the National Dialogue Conference, which I, again, really thought was kind of a waste of time in a lot of ways, but clearly participants didn't. And so I wanted to know more about what it was that they saw and experienced in that process. And it aligned really neatly with the concept of transpositional scrutiny and building consensus around injustice and some of the capabilities approach insights that I try to bring out in the theoretical chapter.
Yeah. And speaking of learning from people that you interviewed, we're curious how you conducted your field research as you were not able to go to Yemen. And then we also had the pandemic on top of that from early 2020, you know, through now until your book was published. So how were you able to conduct your research? What were some of the challenges and what were some lessons that you learned?
Sure. It was hard. And it's not as good as I would like, you know? I mean, like, let me be frank. The first book grew out of ethnographic fieldwork in Yemen with a richness that I would love to be able to replicate. But that's not a possibility under current conditions. And it wasn't really from the transitional period, even, which was marked with a lot of violence and instability. I've done a lot of work with Yemeni communities outside of, and Yemeni activists outside of Yemen. I've been to most of the countries around Yemen over the past decade to meet with people, to Ethiopia, to Istanbul, to places in Europe. So lots of meetings outside of Yemen. But I was reaching the end of how comfortable I felt opining, let's say, about what was happening in Yemen, because the more those conversations occurred, the more aware I was that things had changed seismically. And in 2019, I was invited to participate in a collaborative research project for the first time, where I went to Ethiopia to meet my co-authors, and there were five teams, and each team had an international researcher who had considerable fieldwork experience in Yemen in the past, and two people who were currently living and working in Yemen, in different parts of Yemen, et cetera. And it was a really well-designed collaboration because there were things that I could do as an outsider, data sources I could access and dissemination opportunities that I had that my Yemeni colleagues didn't have. And there was access to field-based research that they had that I didn't have. But we designed the work together, analyzed the results together, I did a lot of the writing, but we worked on the writing together. That was the best of the collaborative projects that I worked on. And I've done some others since then. I've learned that it's really important to structure the grant that funds the research in a way that I'm a third partner or consultant so that I can quit or be fired. I think that's super important. I needed to be able to quit if I felt that the red lines being imposed by conflict actors were distorting what we were saying. I never quit. I never reached that point. But I wanted that exit ability. And I wanted my Yemeni partners to feel that they were the chief stewards of the project. And that was important. Every collaboration I've participated in has been structured that way, but they haven't all worked that way. And international peacebuilding organizations in particular have been really bad on this front. And so without naming names, I will say that one major international donor would routinely call me into meetings without my Yemeni partners. And those were Yemeni partners to whom I was supposed to be reporting, right? And I would have to push back against that every time. And that wasn't explicable in terms of language ability or anything like that. So the deference to whiteness was definitely a part of the international peacebuilding sphere. It's been written about critically, but it was interesting to see it firsthand.
You talk about those kind of collaborative peacebuilding research projects as part of action research, right? That it's not just an intellectual drive behind that work, but there's an ethical commitment. I think it's fair to say. Do you want to reflect on that? Or?
Yeah. So participatory action research, which comes out of a kind of post-positivist tradition in the social sciences, is a situation in which one is not concerned if doing research changes the thing that is being researched. In other words, if a report that I participated in researching and writing changes something, that's okay. That might be actually desirable, right? So the big international project that I was just describing, we were mapping different constellations of conflict actors and the impact that was having on civil society organizations and local level peace building in different parts of the country. And we did the research in 13 governorates in Yemen, so really different conflict conditions in those places, and mapped that there were like six different constellations or combinations of conflict actors. But the peace building process only recognizes two of them. So diagnostically, right, we were doing justice work in the sense that we were engaged in a narration and description of the conflict that was designed to change the approach to the conflict at the international peace brokering scale. So I think that that's a problem in some research traditions, right? That's a kind of researcher intervention in a way. For me, my first degree is in anthropology, where participatory action research is well-grounded. It's never been something that I've struggled with epistemologically. Ethically, I think that if you see a clear misunderstanding of something and you don't endeavor to correct it, I don't know what the point of research is.
Yeah, I think that comes across really clear in this book, given that, you know, the conflict is still playing itself out and you are mapping of the peace process or the peace building actions, the justice work taking place with an eye for how to move forward, right, and to bring a lot of civil actors who are outside of the established formal institutional channels into these conversations. So the the ethical work, the normative work that's going on here in this book, I think is quite explicit and also refreshing, right? I think it's fair to say we don't often see that kind of approach within international relations. Now, I know we're both in the International Relations Department, but you actually consider yourself more of a comparativist first and foremost. So let me ask you a question about that, right? Thinking comparatively about the kind of post-conflict reconstruction and justice work that you're studying here, what would you say are some of the maybe three most important lessons or takeaways that you would point to from the Yemen experience for other researchers working on case studies to pay attention to?
I want to start in a slightly different place, actually, with that and talk about how comparison informed my approach to the book. Because I think, like most people who have written a book, there's a chapter that isn't in the book, right? Like there's a comparative chapter that I wrote about Lebanon, Morocco, and Tunisia that I haven't published. I may or may not ever publish, but it informed the development of a part of the theoretical argument, which was this idea that we can identify clearly instances in which regimes disengage from the justice demands of society, strategically engage or try to co-opt the justice demands of society, and substantively engage them. And so I developed that in the context of a comparative framework. And I think that, and you could say a lot about, like, why did I choose other cases in the Middle East? Because as an Africanist, you know, the transitional justice literature is actually strongest in Latin America and in Africa. So why the Middle East? You know, well, these are comparative examples, actually, that Yemenis were drawing on. And part of what people doing justice work in Yemen are operating against is this toolkit approach that kind of is explicitly comparative, that thinks about what worked elsewhere and what might work here or not work here. And, you know, I watched and listened as Yemenis played with these examples, but almost always turned to regional examples. And the regional examples were on the for the most part, not comprehensively, but for the most part, disappointing. So they didn't get much from the toolkit approach to international justice, but they still have to operate in that context and that language. So having awareness of those alternative trajectories was important. A big takeaway from the Yemeni case for me is the necessity of building from below and recognizing competence and successes where they exist. And I think that's something, actually, like, I don't see why that's a lesson from the Yemen case. I think that's an illustration from in the context of Yemen of something that we should be doing more comprehensively. Which is not to say that I'm in the camp in the transitional justice literature that says all local justice work is preferable to anything else that was ever done somewhere else. I'm not saying that. That's not actually what civil actors are doing. They are reading and thinking comparatively and then thinking about what works locally. Right. They're doing that. What we're not doing is like reading and taking that seriously, reading them and taking those projects and that work seriously. So unpacking and mapping the meaning of the concept of justice and its diversity is important. That has to start by looking at local projects and local level successes and what gets traction.
That's great. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know if the listeners would recognize this since we're kind of talking a lot here in the abstract, but one of the aspects of the book that I love so much was your focus on the agency of everyday actors, right? But also on their humanity. And we're both in an academic discipline that, in the kind of proclaimed pursuit of objectivity, privileges detachment and emotional distance from the subject matter and the subjects themselves. I've never been comfortable with that. I know you have some discomfort about that as well. And in this work, not only is there empathy, but more importantly, there's a recognition of agency and humanity, specifically acknowledging the pain and suffering, but also the love and hope that makes up the human condition and informs actors in their everyday life. This isn't really a question, actually. It's just an invitation to kind of reflect on that in terms of how you saw that playing out in this book, in your work here.
You know, I've thought about this a lot, actually, because you said this to me and some other colleagues have said it in other contexts, including some Yemeni colleagues. And I'm humbled by that observation, but I'm also, like, struck about what it says about what mainstream writing about Yemen is like.
Right.
Right. Because, like, this is not remarkable it's that that is remarkable. It's the flatness and the caricature that exists in so much of the mainstream writing. For me, you know, when I write about these projects, even though I've anonymized so much because of, for safety reasons, right? Like, so I'm not naming people. I'm describing projects sometimes more vaguely than I would like. But there's a person on the other side of that, you often a person I know or talked to.
That's right.
And so that's a big part. I think it, inevitably those are memories for me or mental images of actual people. So that it wasn't hard to do that, but it might be harder to do that if you're not having those conversations or you don't know people.
Yeah, it's probably your anthropologist training kind of seeping in there as well.
Maybe a little bit. I would say on the issue of hope, you know, like things have been pretty bad in Yemen for as long as I've ever worked there. And people have been doing more than just getting by throughout that entire time, too. Like, I think there is a reason that I've continued working on the politics of Yemen and didn't continue elsewhere or it would have been really probably professionally advantageous to develop a new field site at some point when Yemen became inaccessible. But there is something in the hope and in the constant engagement of Yemenis that I find inspiring and I enjoy writing about.
And I'm sure your readers will also find that inspiring and maybe come with a new sense of empathy for the country. I'm wondering if you have any calls to action or resources that you wish to share with us in the audience.
I do. And I'm gonna give you guys a lot of stuff for the program notes. But I think this might surprise you. I'm not actually going to recommend places that people can go to make humanitarian aid donations. That's the kind of go-to move. I'm going to call on people to read Yemenis, right? I tried to use the book as a kind of guided bibliography to a whole lot of knowledge production about Yemen that's happening by Yemenis. I'd love it if, like, the upshot of this book is that people don't read what I write about Yemen anymore, but they read the people who I'm reading and engaging with. The Yemen Policy Center, the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, these are two places that put out a tremendous volume of policy-oriented work that's done by Yemenis, describing dimensions often of the conflict, but also the broader socioeconomic context, some social challenges. And the Yemen Policy Center has something called the Madaniya magazine, which is a kind of cultural magazine where a lot of conflict-related themes come up, but you get some sense of the sort of richness of Yemeni culture and society that I think is wonderful. So don't just read policy briefs, but don't just read policy briefs. Knowledge production is fascinatingly multimodal. A lot of the people who are writing for these policy centers are also writing novels and poetry and short fiction. And there are platforms for publishing it, and there are platforms for publishing it in English. So my colleague and collaborator on a project on women's partisan activism in Yemen, she ran a training for women in political parties, and then she published this short story about the challenges that the mobility challenges women are experiencing in Yemen as a result of the conflict, particularly in Sana'a. And that short fiction, which was sort of done as a digital animated piece on the Yemen Policy Center website, is the most accessed content on that website. Like, people want to access stories as a form of sense making. But what I love about that story is that in the digital presentation of it, there are statistics from her research as a sociologist that pop up on the screen in various points. And so it's a visual medium. So you have to go look at it, but it's called Bus of Hope by Reem Mugahid. And I also, I'm also going to share with you Abdulaziz Makalis' poem, Melody of Our Alienation. He died this fall. And I remember the first time when I was in Yemen, when I was introduced to someone whose job description was poet. And I was really surprised by that at some level, because it was a pretty significant political meeting. And I couldn't figure out why there was a poet there and why everyone was like super deferential to him, too. Yeah. And it was actually a Makaleh who, as I mentioned, died this fall. And there was a lot of kind of public memorial to him. But in 2014, when the Houthi movement came into Sana'a, there was an arts collective called Support Yemen, hashtag supportyemen.org, that was producing, it came out of the uprising. They had met during the uprising and started making short films. And they made a short film adaptation of a poem by Makaleh that's about Sana'a. And it's called The Melody of Our Alienation. And it's beautiful. And this is the same film collective that was involved in producing the film Karama Has No Walls, which means Dignity Has No Walls, about a major civilian massacre that's a documentary that was nominated for an Oscar. I highlight all this because this kind of cultural production is incredibly important to Yemeni civil actors. It's part of where that sense-making is happening, where justice claims are being made. And I feel like it's almost comprehensively off the radar of policymakers in a way that is to the detriment of us all.
Yeah, that's great. I was going to transition from our kind of discussion about your focus on knowledge production and the kind of non-traditional ways of thinking about art, music, and theater, because we always incorporate a non-traditional text here in the podcast, whether it be a song, poem, and a diary entry. And in this case, you referenced a kind of audiovisual piece, right? So we're not going to read anything. We're just going to link into the description here. But do you want to just explain again, like, what this piece is and
sure. So, as I said, the title of it is Melody of Our Alienation. It was produced by a group of very young Yemenis to use the language of a significantly older, kind of eminent Yemeni poet. And the choices that they make about how to embody the idea of Sana'a and the gender story that they're telling in the way that they do it is innovative and unusual in the Yemeni context and really beautiful and powerful. I don't think that the English translation does it justice, or I would just read the poem. But if you watch the video, the subtitles will give you the meaning, but the sound will give you a different layer of meaning.
Right. That's great. And we're going to link to that in our program notes. Stacey, thanks so much for being here and being willing to talk about your new book, Yemen in the Shadow of Transition, again, published by Hearst and Oxford University Press. And Johanna, it has been great to have you with us here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to It's More Complicated Than That, a podcast on world affairs produced by the students and faculty of the International Relations Program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. This episode featured Johanna Golden, Stacey Philbrick-Yotta, and Kevin Dunn. The producer is me, Kelly Walker. This has been a production of the IR program at HWS and of the Geneva Sound Factory. Thank you for listening.